Business Technology Podcast brought to you by the editors at techcentral.co.za. My name is Duncan McLeod, and I'm here with Candace Jones. Hi, Candace.
Hi, Duncan.
Got a special guest in the studio today, Craig Wilson.
Hi, Duncan. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Yeah, no complaints. Thank you.
Good. You're going to be hearing a lot more of Craig in the next little while. He's joining the Tech Central team, effectively taking over from Candace, who's moving on at the end of this month. If you listen to last week's podcast, I think Candace is about to start crying here in the studio.
Weep. It's quite a sad day, but it's exciting to have Craig with us. New addition to the team and some new blood. So looking forward to seeing what he can produce in my stead.
Great. Well, welcome, Craig. I'm really looking forward to working with you in the months and years ahead. And welcome to the team.
Yes, well, thank you. It's nice to be here. It's great to get involved before the official start date and to get a bit of a taste of what you guys do around here.
Great.
So
great.
Thanks for inviting me over.
Awesome. Well, feel free to jump in at any time as we go through the news of the week, as we do every week, every Friday at this time. But let's get straight into it. I think the really big news this week has to be the Microsoft Skype deal. The fact that Microsoft is buying Skype, the online voice over IP provider, for $8.5 billion.
It's about $50 a user.
For $50 per active user.
It's quite a frightening sum, actually. And I think it's it is the largest deal that Microsoft has ever made.
It is. I think the previous biggest one was around $6 billion, which they did in 2008. I forget the name of the company.
Myself.
Yeah, but it's quite a controversial deal, not only because of the price they've paid for it. I was reading a really interesting comment or blog entry this morning. I read some of it to you, Candace, as well. Mm. The blogger suggesting that, why spend $8.5 billion on Skype when, for $1 billion or probably far less, Microsoft could have built their own very, very powerful and good Skype equivalent. I think there's probably a little bit more to that because they are buying a big user base which they could potentially market to, but it does seem from my perspective to be a very risky move by Microsoft and a really big bet by the company's CEO, Steve Ballmer. Craig, what's your take on the situation?
Well, I think the other thing that a lot of people are bandying about is that they bought it more so that no one else could. They bought it to take it off the market and so that other people didn't have the option. And there's also those who are talking about the value it can add to Windows 7 phones going ahead. Of course, whether they'll be able to pull that off, because operators naturally won't take kindly to their voice business being encroached upon in exchange for data, which is far less lucrative, at least overseas, not necessarily here.
Yes.
I think it's a curious move. They obviously weren't the favorites to take it. There was Google and Facebook said to be vying for it.
And Cisco.
Yeah. So it's a bit of a surprise. Yeah. But I think what will be interesting in time is to see whether they overpaid.
Yeah, for sure. The point you made about them keeping Skype out of the hands of a Google or a Facebook, that on its own, I would think, is really not a good business strategy. I mean,
No, absolutely.
Well, Facebook will get it anyway because of Microsoft's investment in Facebook. So they'll probably get integration at some point.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot that Microsoft's an investor in Facebook. I presume that. So they bought 1.6% of the company.
Something like that. Yeah. It was quite a minuscule amount, a percentage of the company. But I think it's actually quite a smart acquisition. Whether or not they overpaid for it is another story. But, looking at that piece you read to me this morning around the discussion saying that they should have perhaps built their own, Apple has tried, and it's not as successful as I'm sure Apple would have liked it to have been. I can't remember what the name of the product is, but they do have a VoIP product that they've created.
So who's at Apple?
Yes.
Well, they've got the FaceTime video calling product, which only works on Apple devices.
Which is, it's slightly less successful than something like Skype. I know the other issue is that I think that Microsoft has not just bought this fancy voice over IP business, but it's actually bought what could potentially be a very lucrative social network. And I think that a lot of people are missing that aspect of it. I mean, if you look at the integration that it's currently planning, Xbox Live, Kinect, Xbox itself, potential for Facebook, all of these things, give it a single Microsoft sign-on, creates a massive user base for Microsoft.
Yeah, but the challenge is, and I think you made the point at the end of your column this week, is Microsoft really has to execute properly on this. And Microsoft hasn't exactly covered itself in glory when it comes to execution around these sort of things. I mean, certainly the company seems to have improved in recent years. They're developing good products. Windows 7 is a very good operating system compared to say, Vista. And the Xbox is doing phenomenally well and probably will do even better now that Sony has dug a hole for itself around the PSN network issue. But yeah, I don't know. This is a big, unwieldy corporation.
Well, like you say, they are doing a lot better. And I think the difference between Microsoft's previous acquisitions, failed acquisitions, and this one now is that Microsoft is actually starting to get back into the game. Whereas before, it was quite complacent with its massive competitive advantage over everybody else. So I think now it really has to start playing the game properly. And I think it knows that.
Hmm. The question is, can it actually do it?
That is the question, yeah. and that remains to be seen. Yeah. We have to wait and see what Microsoft actually does with this stuff.
Craig, I mean, what are your views on Microsoft? When I look at them, they seem to be pulling themselves together after the disaster of Vista and the slow rate of innovation coming out of the company. Well, Windows Phone 7 coming out is out. The deal with Nokia, which is going to be hugely important for them. And by all accounts, their Office 365 cloud-based Office suite is very good, and they're doing great stuff in the cloud on the business side of things. But you know, have they got what it takes, do you think, to compete with the likes of Apple, which just got this absolute? I mean, consumers just love the brand.
Sure. Well, I think there's a lot of faith that Microsoft had to try and re-win on that front, because you know, for so long, as Candace said, they've been seen as sort of complacent and apathetic, just because of the basis of the size of their market share. Mm. However, it does feel like they're a little bit behind the curve, but they're certainly trying to catch up. Mm. I mean, coming up with, as you said, in terms of the Windows 7 phone, you know, it's necessary, but they've lost any head start advantage they might have had. You know, they're going to be trailing Android. They're going to be trailing Apple.
Which is a position Microsoft's never been in before. I mean, they've always dominated the markets they've been in with Office and Windows, which is their traditional strong point. Now they seem to be playing catch-up all the time with everybody else.
Absolutely. And what's also interesting is that they continue to sell what essentially are, you know, proprietary products and proprietary software. And with, you know, more and more things going open source and the Android and, you know, sort of app markets growing and growing, or even the fact that people are prepared to pay for Apple apps, it's a case of will they be able to compete realistically? I don't know. At the same time, they have the money and the experience, you know, behind them. It's a case of, can they be innovative enough to attract what consumers want? Because, you know, Steve Jobs might be able to tell people what they want, but people don't generally like to hear it from Microsoft. Mm. Or, I mean, one of the things I saw today, I mean, this week as well, was the backlash from Skype users. And all of the jokes during the rounds basically suggesting that this was a terrible move and that they would now have to look for alternatives to Skype because they were sure that Microsoft was going to get it wrong.
Yeah, I know people who quit Facebook after Microsoft took a 1.6% stake in these. I don't know, I think it's a bit ideological, but I mean, it's
what Microsoft really lacks, though, is an ecosystem. Whereas other people have, Apple has an ecosystem and Google has an ecosystem. Microsoft lacks that. I mean, the only thing that they have at the moment in the cloud is 365. And what else? What other applications at $5 could I, for example, buy from Microsoft? None.
They don't have a well-developed consumer app store, like, or business app store for that matter. But, you know, oops, sorry, my iPad's making some noises here. It's a friend of mine suggested that Microsoft's biggest problem is that it just lacks marketing nous. They're doing the right things from a product perspective, but they just don't have the marketing creativity of Apple or Steve Jobs. And that perhaps that's their biggest challenge. They just need to bring in a supermarketer to make their image cool again. You're right, Craig. The people, there's almost an antagonism towards Microsoft.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's difficult to imagine how they're going to overcome that negative perception of them that now it seems to exist amongst consumers.
Absolutely, which is funny because in many ways, you know, Apple's market share since the iPhone has gone up and up and up, and people who wouldn't traditionally buy into other Apple products have done so on the back of things like the iPod and the iPad, and arguably they're becoming the sort of behemoth that Microsoft has been for so long.
Yeah.
But it's somehow they've managed to retain the, you know, they're just perceived differently by consumers.
Yeah. I suppose these things go in circles as well, though. You know, at some point, Apple's just going to get so big, hairy, and ugly that consumers are going to start to think the same way of Apple as they now think about Microsoft.
Which is potentially also happening with Google. For a while, Google could do no wrong.
Yeah.
Now we've got the Google-Facebook slandering each other scandal in progress.
Yes.
And suddenly Google are being pointed at and are saying, well, you're endangering users' privacy as well. And, you know, until recently, Google could do no wrong. So perhaps Microsoft can turn it around and go from being the big, bad, evil, faceless corporation to being the next Apple.
Yeah. What's amazing, actually, is I was thinking about this the other day. You know which company it was that actually bailed out Apple back in 96 or 97 when Apple was facing bankruptcy?
Microsoft.
It was Microsoft. They bought a big chunk of Apple and basically bailed them out.
I figure.
Remember that controversial...
I do.
There was that... It was the first keynote that Steve Jobs gave after returning to Apple, and then they had a video link through to Bill Gates at Microsoft, and when Bill Gates appeared on the screen, all the Apple fanboys in the audience just immediately started booing.
Well, the Apple fanboys can be grateful for Microsoft then for saving their company.
Yeah. What's ironic was, you know, Apple bailing out this company, and now Apple has got last quarter reported higher profit for the first time than Microsoft in more than 20 years.
Yes. Such an exciting market at the moment, though.
For sure, yeah. I mean, Apple's market cap is $100 billion more than Microsoft's, and they're saying it could be the first company in the world to get a trillion dollar market.
I saw that this week. Yeah.
That's just scary.
It's a big company. I mean, they're not that far behind ExxonMobil, which is the biggest energy group in the world.
Is it worth that much, though? I mean, is the share price worth that?
Well, I actually looked at the numbers, and I'm not a financial analyst, but I looked at their price earnings multiple and their forward multiple, and you know the numbers that the analysts, basic numbers the analysts tend to look at to determine whether a company is overvalued or not, and on those metrics, Apple's not overvalued at all.
Wow.
Hmm.
Wow, that's a terrifying thought.
And in the last financial quarter, year on year, they grew their profit, their earnings by 95%. This is a massive, massive corporation growing its profits by 95%. It's actually almost unbelievable.
That is unbelievable.
If they can keep up that sort of growth, then a $1 trillion market cap is probably not out of the question.
Wow. I wish I'd invested.
Great. Well, let's move on to our second topic today. I wanted to chat a little bit about the news that the full Android market is finally coming to South Africa.
Good news for us.
Great news for us, especially for Android fanboys like myself.
Yeah.
What phone do you use, Craig?
At the moment, I'm using a Samsung.
Okay. Running what?
Running Bada.
Oh, okay.
Well, I'm not sure if I can tell you this, but it was a sample.
Okay.
It's not entirely a choice thing. I'm quite an Android fan myself.
Yes.
I live with a lot of Android users. It seems, you know, it's either Android or BlackBerry or iOS these days. Mm. My next phone will probably be an Android phone. I think the fact that the marketplace is coming here in full is really exciting, and this continues to be one of the Apple problems.
Yes.
There's still so many products you can't get.
Yeah.
And I know that a lot of South Africans really resent it. And of course, there's also various workarounds, you know, people who register US or UK accounts to be able to use the iStore. Nice that there's no such problems with Android.
Yeah, indeed. I was actually quite surprised to see that games are available in the Android paid-for marketplace, because one of the big gripes of South African iPhone and iPad users is that you can't buy games. I don't even think you can download free games in the Apple App Store. And the reason that I've always seen for this is that Apple didn't want to go through the onerous process of getting approval for each game from the Film and Publications Board. But now Android is launched here with games in its store, and one wonders whether they're getting FPB approval for every single game. I've tried to get some comment from Google out of this, but nothing, I haven't been able to get anything in detail, except for them saying that if anyone has any issue with a particular application they found in the App Store, they can report it to Google. But that doesn't really answer the question.
No.
I've also put in a question to Apple, who haven't responded, asking why there are no, what the official reason is for there being no games in the local App Store. But it's a strange situation.
Well, it drives me mad, because I would love to be able to play Angry Birds, for example, on John's iPad, but I can't, because the only version that's available here is half the version, so or the walkthroughs, which you know, I actually don't have a use for. Yeah. So,
well, you can do to do what the rest of us do and tell Apple that you live in the US and then get full access to the US. Yes.
I wish I'd known about that before I registered. I'm going to have to go through this onerous 26-page.
Well, you can have multiple accounts.
And
mm-hmm. Just create multiple accounts. Create a US account so you can just switch stores.
I can create the US account and still have to go through the 26-page terms and conditions agreement with, which is actually ridiculous. Anyway. John and I were arguing about it the other day about how ridiculous it is. Android's terms and conditions is one page.
Seriously?
One page.
That's amazing.
I'd rather have that. Anyway, so it's quite exciting to see that Google has made a concerted effort to bring not just South Africa, but a whole bunch of other countries.
98 other countries it's
access
coming
to. The full market. I mean, there's so much that we just haven't had access to, and it's just nice to have it now.
Yeah.
And I think that South Africans are becoming more savvy with smartphones and internet access, and I think it'll be a really good boost for local innovation.
And hopefully this will prod Google's rivals to bring the Microsoft App Store here, for Apple to bring games to the local market,
get
around whatever issues that they're having there.
With any luck.
I mean, perhaps Google is just ignoring the FPB. I don't know.
Well, I was going to say, perhaps they're going on the "we'll just do it now and say sorry later" approach.
Exactly.
But I think at the end of the day, consumers would still rather have that be the case.
Yes. I mean, the Film and Publications Board, I don't know if you've ever had the misfortune of dealing with them. I probably don't even know these app stores exist.
No, they probably don't.
There's that too, yeah.
Well, I did hear that they have put out a statement around penny auctions, so on online sites where you can sort of...
The Film and Publications Board?
Yes, put out, you sort of... Oh, no, you're right, it's not, it's the Gambling Board. It's the Gambling Board that deals with that. But anyway, Film and Publications Board, they're more actually focused on porn and child internet porn than they are on any other application services. So I don't know if they've ever had any notice of it.
Yeah. Okay, Telkom, ETA, the... Fourth mobile operator in South Africa has gone for per second billing. I'm surprised they didn't do it at launch.
Because I see Kate shaking her head in disbelief.
It took them long enough. You know, every other operator, including Cell C, offers per second billing. Where was ETA when they launched? Why didn't they offer it then? I honestly have no idea why they didn't do it in the beginning.
I guess it looks cheaper when you bill per minute.
Well, when you do it at slightly reduced rates compared to the competition, sure. Yeah. I was just as surprised when I saw the story on Tech Central about the per-second billing that it was a story at all, because I hadn't even realized that they billed per minute. I just assumed that a new player would necessarily bill per second and that consumers would demand
it too. They should, absolutely. But all the operators still have per minute billing options as well.
They do, which I don't understand. I don't know if anybody actually uses per minute billing at all.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah.
It feels in some ways sometimes like it's one of those things designed to trip people up too. Yeah. I notice that with the ATA you need to actually specify that you want to change over to the per second billing.
Yes.
And for a lot of really, you know, end of the line consumers who don't pay attention to these sort of things, they will be blissfully unaware, and until someone else tells them, or you know, a friend or family member points it out, they'll continue to use per minute billing only because they don't know any better.
Yeah, that's true.
Which unfortunately feels a bit sort of underhanded, but it's the way some companies continue to make more money than they necessarily should.
It's so difficult for consumers to actually make head or tail of this stuff, because the effective per minute rate for per second billing is higher than the per minute billing. because the operator doesn't want to lose there's a revenue loss if they were to set the per minute rate for per second billing at the same as per
same
minute
levels.
I'm doing my tongue.
Say that fast.
I think I said that right. And there's so many different. I mean, I was having a chat with Peter Ace from the CEO of Vodacom the other day as well. The complexity in the market is just unbelievable. The operator that can actually start to reduce some of this complexity, make some of these package choices easier to understand, could actually win some market share.
Well, MTN has done a pretty decent job of that. They put out products that MTN this product at this many minutes, and that's how much you get free. Done. Finished. And I think they cut a lot of the packages that they used to have and introduced the new names for them, and they directly reflect how much airtime you have. It's not as simple as I'd like it to be, but they're far ahead than their competitors in that space.
Well, definitely.
Well, hopefully the Consumer Protection Act will encourage people to be more transparent in their packages too, yeah. because really there's so many packages available that it's so difficult to make head or tail of it. And
yes.
you know, anyone signing up for a new contract, I'm sure, has had the experience of losing hours poring over the different offerings from the different companies to try and decide which one actually makes the most sense for them.
Yeah, it's almost impossible to figure out.
Absolutely, yeah.
No, it is. It's ridiculous.
Well, we have yet another public holiday next week. We'd had enough of those last month to last us a lifetime. But yet another one, out of cycle public holiday, because of course it's the municipal election. And I've been quite fascinated with how the politicians have been using technology in this in the run-up to this election, particularly the DA and the ANC, and particularly how they've been using Twitter as an electioneering platform. Craig, I don't know if you've been following these things like #DAQA and #ANCLive.
Not closely, no, I haven't. Politics is not something I expend too much energy tracking.
That's probably
I did, however, see that Jacob Zuma is now... He's ostensibly on Twitter, or at least the ANC are tweeting for him.
Yes.
Have they done more than one tweet? I haven't checked since I saw the first time.
I haven't either. All I saw afterwards was the slew of comics talking about how jealous they were that he could get so many followers in such a short period of time. But it is fascinating to see people using it. It's also about time, arguably. And obviously, it's fitting that it's only really the biggest parties that can afford the resources required to man this sort of thing. It's also, I think, a little risky of them in a sense, because there's not, relatively, there aren't that many South Africans on platforms like Twitter.
I was about to say that.
And the sorts who are generally quite critical and quite quite scathing. So I think it's a great move from them, because they're arguably, in doing so, pitching to the most critical audience.
Yeah, indeed. Mm. Indeed, also arguably the audience most likely to have made up its mind about which way to vote.
Absolutely, yes.
I was actually looking in my TweetDeck Twitter application this afternoon at the DAQA and ANC Live streams. I was quite interested to see that the DA stream was very sort of positive towards the DA, and the ANC stream was just almost constituted almost entirely criticism of the ANC. But then I suspect that most Twitter users tend towards the DA side of things rather than the ANC side of things. My guess would be that. It's interesting. But Craig, your point that they're really appealing to a niche of the South African population, a small minority of the South African population, is correct. And I wonder if it makes sense for them to be expending so much energy on a platform like Twitter when most South Africans simply don't have access to it.
The DA, I think, definitely. And they started this quite a while ago, the DAQA sessions, and then the ANC followed suit quite a few months later. But the ANC had to respond to that at some point. And even if it's a once every 2 weeks sort of scenario, they had to come onto Twitter and make some sort of response. Whether or not they push a lot of energy into it is another story. I haven't really followed the ANC live one all that closely. But they had to respond, and they had to respond in some way. But for the ANC in general, electioneering probably is not going to happen, or shouldn't really happen, on the internet with as much vigor as it should out in the rural areas.
Mm.
I mean, their voting public is mostly, primarily, not on the internet at all, or have no access. So the DA definitely is looking at a target audience, possibly the target audience that has already been swayed, but the ANC definitely had to respond.
Yeah, but it's good to see. I think it's a good move to see South African politicians starting to use this sort of technology.
I've always been impressed with the presidency. I mean, they've had an online presence for quite some time, and I follow the presidency's YouTube channel, where they actually actually publish little clips, video clips of Zuma speeches and Mokhlante speeches. So they actually have a pretty good online strategy. What I think is a pity is that the people that would be most interested or get most value out of this stuff don't have access to it. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, well, that would actually probably change by the next general election.
It should.
As smartphones just get out there and data prices come down, I think that by the time the next general election comes around, Twitter could be a very important electioneering platform for all parties.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And I think that's why, as you said, it's so important that they get on board
now
so that they don't have to play catch-up when the time when the time comes. I mean, I think one of the blessings about technology in Africa is the fact that you can jump so many steps ahead, in the same way that we jumped ahead of, you know, American analog systems in some senses by going immediately to digital. Some people have skipped desktop computing entirely.
Mm-hmm.
I spent some time last December in Kenya and went for a cooking lesson with a Swahili woman who lived in a house with no electricity and no appliances. And her first question was, "Are you on Facebook?" I said, "What?" She had a phone.
Yes.
And that was it. And when we asked her about it, she said, "I like to chat a lot." Which actually turned out to be code for, "I'm looking for a European husband." But the point is,
did you escape?
There were so many people in Kenya who were active on social networks.
Yes.
But had no access whatsoever to a terrestrial line or a desktop computer. And I agree, you know, as smartphones pick up, it does, you know, make it possible that the constituents actually who really would be most affected or most likely to be swayed may have access.
That's true. I've just realized we're way over time for an ad break, so I think we should probably take one of those. We'll be back right after these messages.
The Vox Superphone and your ADSL line go together like taxis and rush hour.
Ah!
But we do give a hoot. Now you can use your ADSL for more than just surfing. With the Superphone, you can call any phone, anywhere, using your ADSL line. You save money, earn rebates, and box-to-box calls are free. No contracts, just plug and play. Your ADSL and the Vox Superphone. It's the perfect combination. Make the most of your ADSL. Visit voxsuperphone.co.za.
After the advent of the telephone, it took mankind 70 years to invent the color television. And yet, it only took the next 23 years to invent lasers, the internet, to put a man on the moon.
Ignition sequence start.
It begs the question, what will the business world be like in the next 23 years? Wherever your business is at, Telkom Business will be there with you. Telkom Business.
Virtual Access, ECN's latest cost-saving telecom service. Virtual Access is a single 0860 number, providing your customers with national access to your company, no matter how many branches you have or where your customers are calling from. If you are currently using or plan to use an 0860 number, you need to talk to ECN. Virtual Access is the best price single national number offering in the market. For more, visit ecntelecoms.com. ECN. Lowering the cost of doing business.
Welcome back to Talk Central, the business technology podcast brought to you by the editors at techcentral.co.za. My name is Duncan McLeod. I'm here with outgoing Tech Central deputy editor Candace Jones.
Meep, can you stop saying that?
And Craig Wilson, who's going to be joining the Tech Central team on the 1st of June. Hi again, Craig.
Hi.
Cool. What else do we need to talk about this week? I had an interesting interview with the new CEO, acting CEO. Why do state-owned enterprises always have acting CEOs?
They don't want to commit.
Yes. Yeah. The new acting CEO of Broadband Infraco, which is the company created effectively by the former Minister of Public Enterprises, Alec Irwin, to set it up as a state-owned competitor to Telkom. The market has changed really dramatically, and he didn't really want to, and fair enough, didn't really want to comment on my questions about whether it really makes sense for Broadband Infraco to continue to be a state-owned enterprise in the face of all this competition from the private sector. But he promised that some of the issues that they've been dealing with, especially problems around tenders in the procurement department, which resulted in the dismissal, I believe, of several staff members, have now been sorted out. He seems to have a good background. He's a former director general in the Department of Public Enterprises, and he seems to have got his head around the issues facing the company. But I still have to wonder whether this company should be in government hands, given that we've got Fiberco, we've got all the big operators, MTN, Vodacom, Neotel, Dark Fiber Africa, the list goes on, all rolling out fiber. Andrew Shaw, who's the CEO of Infraco, said to me that he says this market is becoming cutthroat and it's becoming more and more difficult to figure out where the revenue and profit is going to come from.
Well, I read that article that you wrote, Duncan, on what Andrew's plans for the company is, but it's just, I have to wonder whether... whether it, even if it fixes every single problem within the business, manages to streamline everything to the nth degree and becomes effectively as well run as any given public or private business, does it have a place left? I mean, can it survive? Is it sustainable? I'm not so sure.
They've got great infrastructure. They should just sell it off. Just don't sell it to Telkom. Because Telkom's already got thousands and hundreds of thousands of kilometers of fiber infrastructure around the country. Why not, I don't know.
Sell it to who, though? Everybody's building their own.
But yeah, they've got a limited amount of infrastructure in the ground. So, I mean, Broadband Infraco's got 12,000 kilometers of fiber in place already. Whereas these other guys, like Fiberco, for example, hasn't even dug a trench yet. So
that's true. That's very true.
But the question is, who do you sell it to? Because, I mean, this is a big chunk of fiber, and we give whoever buys it a huge competitive advantage over the guys who haven't started trenching yet.
Well, perhaps then the whole idea will give Infraco, well, not selling off will give Infraco that competitive advantage.
Mm.
But again, I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen any advertising. I haven't seen any space where it's actually, you know, it made any impact. And that's actually something that I was hoping to do this coming week, was to look at the actual impact of Infraco in the market so far since they launched.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know if the company is worth holding on to.
Yeah. Are they talking about potentially merging it with Centec? Creating a sort of super state-owned telecoms operator.
Because Centec are so famous and popular for getting so much done.
I see the synergies, yes. But at the same time, I can also see where it can go disastrously wrong. Definitely if, you know, Infraco provided the backhaul and the national network and the fiber to whatever access networks need to be created, and Centec then creates the access networks to wherever it is that they want to. I think they're talking schools and clinics and the like. I could see it working in that respect. I don't think they need to merge as a business to do that. I think they could partner to do that and still be fine. I both companies as state-owned operations, both outside in two separate ministries, both run with very different visions and launched with very different visions. I don't know. Besides that, I still think that Centec shouldn't get into the broadband game at all. So there is another issue that could crop up with a partnership between the two of them.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't see it happening, and I don't see it being a success.
I mean, we've said this on the show before. It would make more sense to use the what's it called, the fund that the operators contribute into, the SASA, Universal Service Fund. I mean, there's over R1 billion sitting in there. Give that to Vodacom and MTN and Cell C, whoever else wants, who can actually deliver these services into the rural areas and just get the job done.
Yeah, sell off the infrastructure that Infraco has. Use that money to put back into whatever rural rollout incentives you could want for bigger operators that have rural rollout and who need to roll out in rural areas, rather than hanging on to the infrastructure that Infraco has or even adding infrastructure to Centec.
Yeah,
I think it's ridiculous. Agree.
Makes sense. Speaking of government fiber projects, I went to the update press conference in Westbury Secondary School this week. For the city of Johannesburg's fiber rollout project, they're spending 1.2 billion rand in total over a couple of years, rolling out just over 1,000 kilometers of fiber, I think it is, to link various parts of Johannesburg together. They're doing the build in partnership with Ericsson. They've rolled out 300 kilometers so far, mainly linking up city of Johannesburg buildings, but the plan eventually is to extend that out to provide services to other to commercial buildings or private sector owned companies as well, and also to sell capacity on that network to internet service providers, who then will presumably provide wireless access to consumers. More state intervention in a market that, I don't know, I'm not convinced needs it.
Aside from the fact that it's more government intervention, it's not the only project in Gauteng. There's also the Blue IQ Gauteng broadband project. I mean, I don't know how Gauteng is doing one thing, Joburg is doing another. Why aren't they working in conjunction?
Yeah,
why
they should be. And we still haven't seen the so-called broadband strategy document the Minister of Communications is supposed to be putting together, which was supposed to be here last year already, wasn't it?
Last year, the year before, it just keeps dragging on.
It's a duplication of investment by state entities.
And we need to actually have that sorted out. The trouble is that Roy Padiachi, Communications Minister, is in a little bit of a bind because the communications portfolio is one of the few portfolios that doesn't extend into local government. So basically, Minister Pagliacci has got control over the entire country. And the departments or the municipalities are just doing their own thing without consulting with anybody.
Mm.
So it's kind of like he needs to clamp down on that stuff, or at least implement local government communications departments.
Yeah.
But it's a tough...
We must follow up on that. We need to find out why it's taking them so long to come up with this broadband strategy document. I know it must take some time to talk to all these various government entities and, you know, slowly government bureaucracies move. But it does seem to be taking an inordinate amount of time for them to get the strategy document.
Well, to be fair, there's quite a lot that he needs to get out there. And one of the more important things that he needs to get out is the manufacturing strategy for set-top boxes, along with the subsidy clarification for those set-top boxes.
Very busy minister.
I don't know how he manages to control both the telecoms and the broadcasting portfolios, because those two are exceptionally big and there are a lot of big projects going on now.
Yeah.
So, you know... I do feel for him, but at some point you have to delegate.
Yes.
The stuff needs to happen.
Yeah. I believe he does work incredible hours.
I'm sure he does.
I hear that he's in the office at like 1 in the morning, 2 in the morning sometimes.
I'm sure he does.
Anyway, so Dye Data has got new branding, or Dimension Data, as they don't. I don't think they like this term Dye Data anymore. Dimension Data has a new branding. Not a huge change on what went before, but
it's quite subtle, isn't it?
Yeah. Same logo, but only lime green now.
Limeish green. Kind of looks like the Vox Telecom colours, actually.
It does a little, yeah. I was quite surprised by the colour.
Yeah.
I would have thought they would have gone with the dark blue of their parent company, NTT.
Yes.
But
that might have been too radical a change.
Perhaps.
At least they didn't go with red and spend a lot of money telling us all about it.
I actually saw the new branding at a presentation by Dimension Data's chairman Ndile Nkaba the day before they launched the branding. And actually, the branding launch was quite fun because they had a really fun photo of Jeremy Orr.
Jeremy Orr, yeah.
many, many years ago, compared to... Well, that's in the 70s.
The one with the moustache.
Yes.
And the waving locks. Yes.
He looked like a 70s geek.
Yeah.
He looked like he could have come straight out of a Microsoft startup photo. And it was actually quite fun to see. A big difference now.
Yeah.
Now he looks all sophisticated and
corporate-like.
Yes,
and it's a nice idea. It's a nice way to get the message across.
I think so.
That innovation's nice important idea. And change is good.
Yeah.
I mean, they've had the same logo since they basically started, as far as I know. Long time, at least 2 decades.
I've never
same
seen
logo.
A change. So,
I suppose the interesting thing is the deal with the reason they've been rebranded, right? And is it NTT?
NTT.
NTT, yeah.
It's a huge injection and a big change for them. They've delisted, haven't they?
That's right.
They have, yeah.
24.4 billion rand all cash deal. Jeremy and the boys made quite a bit of cash out of that.
NTT put out a financial statement this morning, which I went through to see if anything was in there about Dimension Data. They're looking like a very strong company.
NTT or Dadata?
NTT. Okay. Dadata was barely mentioned.
Dadata is going to... I was chatting to Jeremy Ord the morning of the rebranding, and he said that they will be publishing their results, continue to publish their results. So their 6 months to March is going to be published in mid-June.
Well, actually, NTT is pretty good about that. Every single one of their divisions or their businesses do actually report individually, which is quite cool. So you can actually see each individual business... where a couple of international companies that buy into South African businesses usually just swallow them up and they don't report separately.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite nice to see that they do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's nice that they're reporting at all, right? Because they're no longer obliged
They're no longer obliged to report, that's right.
It's a sort of nice gesture of transparency.
It is.
And
it is.
You know, for investors or
shareholders alike. Well, I'm sure all those Dye Data shareholders who lost the opportunity to invest in the company would be quite pissed off if Dye Data's earnings rocket through the roof.
Yes, it's quite.
And missed out on all the
good
growth.
Stuff. Yeah.
And I believe they are doing quite well. I mean, they seem to be a pretty cohesive organization now. They seem to be firing all cylinders. They seem to be getting the marketing message across. They seem to be... It's a pretty energized environment.
I was also mentioned that NTT are taking a fairly hands-off approach, it seems.
Yeah.
Letting them continue.
Yeah, that's right. They've got three Japanese... I should say NTT, of course, is the biggest telco operator in Japan, the second biggest telco operator in the world by revenue, after AT&T. And they're indeed, you're right, they're taking a hands-off approach. They've got three NTT directors on the board, but they're really allowing the Dye Data guys to go on and get things done. Interestingly, they're looking at potential acquisitions together, which could be fascinating to watch, see where they do deals.
I'd like to see who they would buy. You know, they're a pretty strong company and they've got a pretty strong vision and they've covered all their bases effectively and, you know, they run with solid growth. But I suppose...
I'd imagine it'd be in the IT services space, so they'd look at consulting companies or outsourcing companies in markets where perhaps they don't have strength or service areas where they don't have strength or in geographies where they're not that well represented.
Very possible. I'd like to see where they go. It's an interesting and definitely an interesting, it's been an interesting company for 10 years and definitely going to be an interesting company for the next 10
years. Yeah. Well, I had to have a good laugh. You know the Didata green triangle?
Yes.
If you have a look at it, and I mentioned this to, someone mentioned this to me the other day, and I mentioned it to some of the Didata executives, and apparently it's been a bit of a joke inside Didata for years. But if you look at it, and you look at the white bit on the green background, it looks exactly like a white g-string on a green background.
Shocking. But now that you mention it.
Yes. since I heard that earlier this week, I don't think I'm ever going to get that out of my mind whenever I see the Didata logo.
Thanks for that. Great images for the weekend for everyone.
Craig, you specifically mentioned that you wanted to chat a bit about Google's new Chromebooks. I haven't looked at it in a lot of detail, but I saw Larry Page, I think it was Larry, was it either Sergey Brin or Larry Page yesterday, was making some quite strong remarks about Windows not being not delivering on consumer expectations, and that these new Chrome OS based laptops are going to be a revolution for computer users who don't want the complexity of Windows. Just you know a bit more about these products.
What do they think? I think in a sense that complexity of Windows is a big attribute of it. I think that the Chromebooks are very interesting for a certain market. They're not overly powerful machines necessarily, and they're you know, some of them have terribly small hard drives. They're talking about as little as 16 gigs in some of the first ones to come out.
But you don't really need a big hard drive though, because this is a cloud-based...
Well, that's exactly the argument. But of course, I mean, part of the problem, I think it's certainly more applicable to first world markets. One of the problems here is that you're assuming internet access, and you're assuming ubiquitous internet access, which, you know, even at the moment you can't always get in all the airports, and, you know, there are only so many restaurants and bars, and, you know, in terms of public accessibility to Wi-Fi, we're not quite at the level where I think that would necessarily be viable. There is, of course, a lot of talk too that while it will be cloud-based, much like the options that Google's built into Gmail and into Google Calendar, where you can use it offline, and as soon as you go online, it just syncs with your account. You know, I think we're perhaps a bit more, some African consumers, I'd imagine, are a bit more reluctant to pick that up. Mm-hmm. Also because I think some people are still having trouble adapting to the idea that you would put everything in the cloud and leave it to someone else's discretion to look after your data. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, I think they're interesting models. I think in terms of competitors, it seems to me like they're pitching it in the same way that the MacBook Air is pitched. You know, it's not pitched at the sorts who want to use, who need the processing power to be editing video or, you know, doing or gaming or that sort of thing on the move. It's the sort of people who deal with documents and email and just want to do basic computing.
But if you want to, I mean, I'm just imagining that I'm going to a press conference, it happens to be, and they very often are in the basement of some hotel where there's no 3G reception, there's no Wi-Fi or anything. If I open up one of these Chromebooks, am I going to be able to start taking notes and editing copy? Or am I going to have to connect to the internet before I can do anything?
Well, that's one of the big questions that remains to be seen. I got the impression from the reading I've done that you would certainly be able to function.
Okay.
I don't think they could cripple it to that extent. You'll certainly be able to do some of the things you're used to doing. But obviously, it will be largely cloud-reliant when it comes to anything bigger and in terms of storing your data. So I'm sure you can type up a document, but you may have to get online to save it, ridiculously.
Yeah, I guess they'll use Google Gears and Google Docs offline and that sort of thing to get around the connectivity issues that people will inevitably face, even in the most developed and well-connected markets.
Absolutely. I think it's most interesting from an OS point of view, really. The fact that Google, you know, the Chrome OS has been talked about since 2009. It's been growing and developing slowly, which also seems to suggest, hopefully, that they've been working really hard at it. And, you know, as Android has shaken up the mobile phone market, it's nice, I think, to have another OS trying to influence the mobile computing market. And Google's reputation, at least, well, as you said, slightly tarnished this week with the Facebook story, but otherwise...
I think Facebook's
tarnished. And the other way around, yes. Even more so, right? But Google, you know, there's still a lot of people who have a great trust in the brand, and I think a lot of people would be interested to see what they can do in an OS, because obviously they haven't had much to do with, you know, things relating to hardware before now.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm really keen to play around with one of these Chromebooks. Hopefully the local Google office is going to get a few in. Go around there and have a look and see how it works exactly.
Sure.
Great. Good. I think we're almost done for this week, Candice. You've just broken a story on TechCentral about WOW TV walking on water television, which is one of the pay TV licensees from back in, when was it, 2007?
Yep.
there were four of them, four new operators who were licensed. There was Telkom Media, which later became Super 5 Media, which then went bust. Pretty much. Well, they retrenched all their staff. They may still be bringing something out later. It seems unlikely.
Believe it when I see it.
There was ESAT, which is the owner of ETV, or sister company to ETV, which decided not to launch a pay TV product when they saw how many licenses were issued, and instead decided to launch the e-news channel with DSTV. Then there was On Digital Media, which launched Top TV, which is the only one that's actually launched commercially of those licensees.
Yay, and they've been going for a year this month.
And they're doing all right. They've got somewhere anywhere between 200,000 and 250,000 customers at the moment. Mm-hmm.
Depending whose report you believe.
Yeah. Over 250,000 is what Eloise Kelly, the marketing person at On Digital Media,
told me. That's a reasonable performance in the first year of operation.
Well, if I remember correctly, they needed 200,000 customers to break even.
Is that all? Okay.
So I could be wrong about that, but that is something that I remember them saying right at the beginning when they were launching.
Okay. I know they've been having some challenges around their call center and around various other bits and pieces.
But some advertising issues.
What you expect in a startup company.
Teething problems.
And then, of course, the fourth of the new licensees was, use the word new anymore, license 4 years ago. The last of the licensees is Walking on Water Television, which was going to be this Christian family values oriented channel. A lot of people said, well, this is just going to be a religious channel. That was never really the intention, but they struggled to get funding, and they decided that a one channel strategy wasn't going to cut it in a market where you've got Top TV and DSTV. Now, you spoke to one of their co-founders earlier this week.
And yes, actually, they finally have sorted out their funding issues. They've now got enough funding to launch a multi-channel model. From what I understand, anywhere between 2 or 4 bouquets, ranging from between 49 rand to 99 rand. They have until March next year to launch, because ICASA actually only gave them the license, or actually only really licensed them in March this year, when they proved to ICASA that they were properly funded. So while they were awarded the license, they didn't actually get it until March this year, which means they have until March next year to launch. So unlike the others, who, or Super 5 Media, who keeps asking for extensions, and every time they do, they get 6 months. Walking on Water actually has 12 months to launch. But they're saying that they will launch hopefully before that. They're pushing as hard as they can to get something up as soon as possible. For those action junkies and late night steamy hits, don't bother. No sexual content and no violent content, and there'll be a strong focus on local content and exposing local talent, which I think is a good thing.
South Africa is a very religious country.
There are very many conservative people, and it's quite a massive conservative market to actually reach, and that kind of programming, for example, would be ideal for those people.
Yeah. I'm certainly not giving up my Mnet Action channel and the rest of it.
Me either. Bad Boys 2.
You won't be seeing that on WOW TV.
Or any late night Naked News that's also been
Missing a stir. I was actually listening to the radio the other day, and the guy who actually owns the rights to that that Naked News channel was being lambasted by one of the 702 presenters. He was convinced that it's not sexual.
The news naked channel, women, not sexual.
Where women strip while they're reading the news, and it's not sexual.
I'm only amazed no one's done it before.
When they first launched in the States, I went to watch it on the web just out of curiosity, and it's dreadful.
They've apparently won some awards for the quality of their news, though.
Really?
But apparently they have to replay some of the news articles during the show, just in case you missed something while watching.
You might get to wonder.
Oh, well.
All right, we'll never be doing this podcast naked, but at least I hope not.
Thank heavens.
But I think it's time we've got for this week. So, Craig, thank you so much for coming in this week, and we'll see you back in these studios and back in these offices in about 3 weeks' time.
Yep, you will. Thanks very much. It's been great to be here.
Thanks for coming in. Looking forward to it. And Candice, we will see you next week.
Yep.
As always, if you've got any feedback on the show, you can email us at info@techcentral.co.za. We can leave a comment under the post on the website. Until next time, cheers.